So first, I'd like to thank everyone for coming today and the panelists for agreeing to speak. And I'd also like to thank especially Representative Mike Doyle and his office, particularly Ken DeGraff, who sponsored this room for us today, not because he necessarily agrees with any particular point of view being presented here, but just because he believes in the spirit of open discussions on this important topic. And so I'm really very grateful. Now, the broadband part of the stimulus bill has been the subject of a lot of discussion lately. But we're going to take a step back today to look a bit at some of the fundamental characteristics of broadband's interaction with the economy and discuss the idea of a stimulus within that context. In particular, it's important to know what broadband's contribution to economic growth really is and how the financial crisis has affected investment. You've heard lots of numbers on broadband and growth, but those are often not quite correct because they might mistakenly attribute correlation to causality and attribute all the gains brought by the internet to broadband and assume that the next incremental improvements will bring about the same additional gains. Professor Shane Greenstein will present new research on exactly this topic. Chris King from Stifel Nicolaus will discuss investment trends and other relevant data and show how that should inform a stimulus package to ensure that such a package really would do something on the margin, as economists would say, something that wouldn't happen otherwise. And Dr. Bob Crandall, James Assey from the National Cable and Telecommunications Association will discuss cable's experience and investment in broadband infrastructure and their view of a stimulus package. Dr. Bob Crandall, whose work has played prominently in the debate, will also touch on these issues, and because since much of his work has been used and often cited not quite correctly, and he'll build on that knowledge to discuss how we might think about a stimulus. And finally, we have a new addition to the panel. Christoph Steck is the Director of Public Policy in Telefonica, and he's going to give us a European view of the broadband stimulus debate, in part because Europe is beginning to talk about some of these same issues, and what they do is certainly going to be informed by what we do. And he'll also talk about Telefonica's experiences with the capital markets since the financial crisis began. There is kind of an order to the way people are seated and will go, although it's partly because as a W, I never like to go in alphabetical order, so I always make it my prerogative to mix things up a little bit. So each panelist will speak for about 15 minutes, and then we'll open it up.
Weather. It's just wonderful to leave Chicago and get this wonderful 30-degree warmth. I'm going to stick to the paper that we wrote, and my intent here is to give you a broad overview of what happened in the last 10 years, and then some of the implications of thinking about the economic benefits of what happened. And then I'll spend a little bit of time at the end about some of the implications of that. Okay. So there's actually this academic paper that goes with this talk. So I'll stick to that at the beginning. The paper is addressed at a very straightforward, seemingly straightforward question, which is what is the value created by a new good? That's a question that arises in the case of broadband because you have old replacing new, and the numbers are really quite astounding. In 2001, you have 45 million households with dial-up, 10 million using broadband. By 2006, you've almost the reverse. I can't even see my own numbers. 34 million using dial-up and 47 million using broadband. And in the annals of technical change, that's pretty impressive and astounding. And so there's a natural question to be asked: what value was created by that? Now that question is also interesting just because this industry is large. The estimates in 2006 were that it was a $39 billion industry, and for an industry that's no more than 15 years old, that's also quite impressive. So what the paper aspires to do is provide a benchmark for thinking through. Those estimates, it's relentlessly quantitative and assembles the best public data I could find, or that Ryan could find. and it's going to provide two traditional economic measures of value. One is you look at the new GDP created by the technology. The other is what would be known as the consumer surplus created by the deployment of the technology in comparison to the old. I'm also going to apply one other really rather old lesson to this exercise, which is one that Robert Fogel is known for, and that's that the contribution to growth, economic growth, from a new technology is the right comparison you should think about is the comparison between what occurred as a consequence of that new technology in comparison to what would have occurred had the technology never showed up. And in his case, he was looking at railroads versus canals in the short period when railroads first deployed. The analogous thing here is broadband versus dial-up in the short period when broadband first deployed. So let me just give you the bottom line. The bottom line is that if you look at that $39 billion number in 06, 28 billion of it approximately is going to be in households, and of that, something like 20 to 22 billion of that is going to be broadband. And what I want you to think about is when you see that 20 to 22 billion dollar revenue, how much of that is coming of that? I'm sorry, 20 to 22 billion of the household revenue. With numbers, I'm always accustomed to having them right in front of me. I have to say 20 to 22 billion is revenue, and I want you to think about when you see $20 billion, how much of that is new. Well, we estimate somewhere between $8 and $10 billion of that is coming from just the deployment of a new good, that it wouldn't have occurred had broadband not shown up. And then we want to think about somewhere between $4 and $6 billion being for something like consumer surplus, that is, a benefit users are getting that they would not otherwise have gotten from dial-up. That's equivalent, interesting, I'm an economist by training, that's equivalent to something like a 1.5% to 2.2% price decline per year over the 8 years we're going to look at. And the interesting thing about that is to recognize that it came much earlier than is typically shows up in government statistics. And that's, again, because users are getting this benefit from the upgrade. Okay, so... Then finally, what else I might say about this? The other remark I would say is just as an overview, when you think about broadband, you should also think of it like a lot of other technologies. You show this to people who do GDP accounting, and they'd say this looks pretty big. You rarely are able to trace growth in GDP to an actual deployment of a technology, and that seems rather large. At the same time, I want to be very clear here. This is just like almost every other technology that's ever diffused in the history. It's not revolutionary. It's generating economic growth, but let's not get carried away. These estimates don't look like a lot of other people's estimates. I've been asked this question a bunch, and there are a couple reasons for it. One is because we're doing a historical estimate rather than a forecast. So, we have historical numbers now, so that grounds us. And the second thing is that we're doing it very strictly using these economic methods, and that's not what everybody else does necessarily. So, okay. So I'm going to just move right into it. Give you a quick overview. Go to the next slide. Yeah. Let me give you a quick overview of how we're thinking about things. The relevant question to ask is, how much additional benefit does a new technology generate? Generally, what you wanted to do is divide those benefits between users and producers. And we're just going to follow convention in the way we do things. We're not going to worry very much about who wins. In other words, I could talk about cable companies and telephone companies and dial-up ISPs, but I'm generally not going to. Right. We have some. Sometimes you can just see it's obvious, and so I'll mention it. But most of the time, I'm not going to worry about that. And similarly with households, I'm just going to give you aggregate numbers. A traditional way of looking at things is to focus on what would be called a willingness to pay measure of economic value. The suppliers and the buyers involved in a transaction are anticipating a set of benefits, and the suppliers are anticipating a set of costs. The two of them make a transaction. In this case, it's for broadband. And those things are internalized in the price that you observe, and that's the way we think about value. Such things that show up here are like the price of second lines. Users are, in the dial-up world, were putting out second lines in their households in order to support the dial-up internet access. They had an ISP. Many of them also had ISP contracts. And then, of course, they're saving on that second line as well. And then there's some anticipated benefits in their entertainment and in their health and commute and so on. To be clear, there's something that's not involved here. People who do growth economics call it growth externalities, that is, things outside the transactions which either benefit or are hurt by the transaction. We are not accounting for growth externalities, and I want to be very clear about that. That's one of the differences of what we're doing with what you often see other people do. What would be a growth externality here, just to be clear, would be something like Amazon is anticipating having more sales because they see on the margin there's now going to be more users in broadband. Google sells more advertising because they see that the time online is going up. Cisco sells more equipment on the margin because they see more households are online. Similarly, these externalities can go negative. An example of a negative one is somebody, if you're on a cable architecture in your neighborhood and somebody gets online and then they start using peer-to-peer, that slows down your applications. That's a negative externality. Again, it's not part of the transaction as long as you're not as long as you're not bribing your neighbor not to be on P2P, right? As long as there's no economic transaction. Okay. The last thing to say here is that the willingness to pay, you have to be actually really careful what you mean by that here. I'm going to do willingness to pay for the upgrade, and I'm going to be very particular in what I'm going to use for that measure. I'll just give you a brief overview. The paper talks at some length about this. We're going to use some estimates from Scott Savage and Don Waldman. And in particular, what they focused on in their estimates of willingness to pay was the willingness to pay for the upgrade. And that's actually the key thing you have to think through. Okay. All right. So I'm going to go over a little bit of the data really quick. I suspect for many of you, this will be actually the most valuable thing in the talk. You know, what actually happened? So the overview is, pretty well known. Dial-up shows up first around 1994, 1995. It starts to really expand in 1996 as a consequence of the commercialization of the browser. Broadband shows up in small measure in experiments at the same time, but really doesn't start to develop until after that, until 1999, which is why we start in 99. There's still very little broadband in 99, but then it starts to explode around 01. Why does it explode? Well, basically, it's because it becomes more available, it becomes higher quality, users perceive it as higher quality, that the service is better and it's more reliable, and perhaps they just didn't even know that it was in their neighborhood. All those things start to add up, and you start to see a number of households switch. Here's the standard graph that goes with this. This is coming out of the NTIA estimates that up until 03. The top line is use of computers, the second line is just use of the dial-up internet, and the bottom line is use of broadband, and this continues and accelerates actually after 03. This is from the paper. What we did is we went through the FCC's numbers. This is their numbers about lines, broadband lines. You could go look this up as well, and the references are in the paper, and it's the same story that things are growing. There's a slight discrepancy at the very end of the data, which I'll talk about if we have time. Yeah. Then there's one last thing. I had to do a lot of work to put this together. U.S. Census puts up estimates of the total revenue for the access industry, and if you go fishing through their data at length, this is what graduate students are really good at doing. Then you can put this together, and then we had to clean it up quite a bit because of some idiosyncrasies of the data. And again, the appendix talks at length about this. Okay, finally, here's the CPI. This is again the price index for internet access in the United States. If you look at this series at length, you'll realize there's something funny about it, which is that prices don't go down until the end of 06. Which seems kind of odd since we had a boom and a bust and we had all sorts of other things for all these years, and it seems nothing happened to prices. Let me just tell you why it did go down. That's because AOL went from subscription-based to advertising-supported prices at the end of 06. That's what's driving that index. What the index is not doing is it's doing a weighted average between broadband and dial-up, and it's not accounting for the upgrade at all. Okay. I just said that, so let's go on. So let's look at data. So what we're going to do is we're going to get the best publicly available data we can. Again, happy to get what you. I think many people will find this valuable. We just took a lot of time fishing through things and tried to make it distilled for you of what happened. So what we're going to do is take the NTIA data on adoption. We're going to supplement it with the Pew data. So Pew Charitable Trusts has a program on the use of the internet at households that in the last couple of years had superior to anything collected by the U.S. government. And then we're going to make some estimates about the rate of switching. We're going to do aggressive and unaggressive switching. We're going to do some different simulations based on what we learned from talking to John Horgan, who's at Pew, who's collected this data. Then finally, we're just going to assume constant prices just for the sake of making this simple. And the paper does talk a little bit about if prices went down a little bit or a lot, what would have changed. But by and large, we'll assume dial-up was 20 and broadband was either $36 or $40. Okay. So, okay, here's that table that took a lot of time to put together. And you can examine it in the paper if you like. It just says the same thing as the prior graphs. Broadband diffused, replaced dial-up. Dial-up starting to decline. Okay, so now we do our simulation, and what do you get? Well, first thing is this table 4. What table 4 is doing is I got a lot of good comments from people, and I want to really thank those of you who sent me emails. What table 4 is doing is to be very clear, it's taking the 2006 revenue numbers, and it's trying to decompose that into when the revenue showed up. Did it show up from a 1999 adoption or a 2000 adoption and so on? And so that's what that shows you, that how much of the revenue you observe in 06 is new, that is to say something that would not have arisen due to dial-up, and decomposing it over time, where is it coming from? And the basic bottom line is it's about $10 billion, somewhere between $8 and $10 billion. And much of it is showing up recently. And that's just because the diffusion of broadband accelerated in about 03, 04. Okay, so that's number one. Let's go on. Number two, we then did a similar sort of exercise for consumer surplus, that is the gain to users above and beyond the price they were paying in comparison to what they would have gotten from dial-up. We're using, in this case, the Savage and Waldman estimates. Again, why did we use this estimate? There are other estimates of broadband demand, because Savage and Waldman, what they did is they did an estimate of the customer willingness to pay for characteristics of the product, that is, to pay for higher speed, to pay for more convenience. And so that lets you do a direct comparison between the characteristics of dial-up and broadband. That's the interesting question. That's why we did it this way. I'm the first to say because that's the estimates we're using, we're also being rather conservative when we see somebody using broadband, but they didn't have any experience with dial-up. That doesn't happen, by the way, in 2001. You know, everybody in 2001 who uses broadband had previous experience with dial-up. But in 2006 data, you do start to see things like that. And so we're largely attributing to those people no surplus, and that's a conservative approach because we just actually don't know how to estimate that given these numbers. Okay, and so here's the result. It's decomposed the same way as the prior table. We look at a total number in 06, and then we decompose it from when it's showing up. And again, it has the same properties as the prior table, that most of the consumer surplus is coming recently because most of the adoption is coming recently. Okay, finally, the numbers are somewhere between $4 to $6 billion of consumer surplus. All right, now let me go, for the sake of time, let me finish up here. You can re-express that as a price decline. That is, someone was willing to pay $51, they only had to pay $40. What would be the equivalent in a consumer price index from the price decline from $51 to $40? Okay? So it's as if they were using dial-up, they then upgrade to broadband, and they're paying $40. But it's as if they get a price break when they do it, because they were willing to pay much more than that. Okay, so that's an intuition for how to think through an upgrade and the price equivalent upgrade that goes back to Sir John Hicks. It's a really old idea. And so we recalculated everything we said here as a price break, and here's what you get. As it turns out, it's equivalent to about a 1.6 to 2.2 price decline per year. The paper also does a Lespers and Posh Index, and if you have no idea what that is, don't worry. It's a sort of a different way of doing the same thing, and in bounding this on the high end and the low end, so those estimates come somewhere between 1% and 3.4. This is right in the middle, and the whole point is that you're getting the equivalent of 20% decline in price over these 8 years leading up to 06, just from the fact that people are upgrading. And it has nothing to do with AOL's pricing. It's just having to do with the upgrade to a higher quality service. And our point, one of our points is that it came much sooner than was noted. Okay, so let me finish up here. I'll go to implications. So first of all, you know, the direct effect of the paper was just to try to help people understand. When you see that $39 billion, 20 to 22 billion of it's coming from household broadband. Of that, something like 10 billion of it is new. Something like four to 6 billion of that is consumer surplus affiliated with that. What other implications come out from this? If you were worried about the stimulus bill on broadband, I'd say a couple implications also come out. Next slide, yeah. The first implication is, well, if you wanted to subsidize rural broadband, what would you get from this? Well, the first thing you'd recognize is that for 8 years we've had private, or 10 years or longer, we've had private industry already trying to get a return on its investment. So the consequence is you necessarily have no low-hanging fruit left. So everything left, by definition, is high cost. What we've observed prior was a retrofit on existing infrastructure in order to get a revenue, and that's all been done. So now, by definition, you're going to get is something that's very costly to do. By definition, you're also necessarily going to get people who are more reluctant to adopt. That's just by definition, because all the people who are enthusiastic already adopted. The second thing that's also going to be true, again, by definition, is since by the standards of diffusion of new technologies, we're near the end of the diffusion cycle, or we're at the end of the S-curve, as people would say, we're necessarily have a choice between either pushing that S-curve a little bit further or going to the next generation of things. That's just a historical cycle that happens in every technology. That's nothing new, and so we're either, you sort of have a choice as a policy to choose between those two to subsidize if that's what you want to do. A second implication that comes from this is how do you think through growth externalities? Well, in the period that we just looked at, there clearly were some growth externalities. They're not in the paper, but how should you think about them? You should think about them as things like YouTube, Facebook, and Flickr. You should also think of them as things like iTunes, and Google. These were things whose quality increased because there was this complementary good that was deploying, and so the value of something like downloading music went up because you had this complement available. It also means that stuff's been invented. It's kind of done. Sure, there's more to come. There's another generation of things to come for faster broadband, but you should be clear that a lot of the growth externalities have sort of been put out of the system. One of the interesting things I find about this episode of the last 8 years was the growth externality some of us anticipated, who were optimistic, and they didn't really arise. Skype, I thought was going to revolutionize. I still hope it does someday. But eBay paid far too much for it, and that's pretty clear now. Another thing that some of us also hoped was online gaming or online communities, and it's a niche use still today. It may someday be big. Now, there's an open question again. If you're thinking this through, next generation for the next wave, what will those growth externalities be? I don't know any better than anyone else, but I'm just framing the question. I would just say that the local ones are very hard to see. The more visible ones are the ones that I would actually say is an open question. We're trying to figure out how big they were in this case, like at Google. That's an interesting question. VCs are focused on the next wave, but in the wireless world, because of all the new apps, the ones that are local tend to be things like real estate, and let's be clear, these externalities go both ways. So local newspapers are the negative side of this. Okay, and last slide, and then finally. And then the last thing that the paper, the sort of unstated message, but for this audience it's worth saying, is that, Pew, a charitable trust, has the best data on household use of the Internet in the United States. And whenever I travel around the world, people in other countries look at me and ask why it is that a charitable foundation, rather than the U.S. government, is the best statistical agency on this topic. And why is that? And I can't really give them a good answer. But I'll just say, when you try to get data on this topic, it's actually quite difficult. You have to go to various different agencies, and I tried to give you some sense of each agency has its mission, and so you have to recognize that, and then you get the data that you want. But as a consequence, there's a whole bunch of things that just nobody collects data on, like, different broadband price index. That's not what the BLS does. BLS does an average price per a market. That's not, you know, they're not supposed to do a broadband index. Nobody does anything on upgrades. Nobody's doing anything on availability, and that's because it's just not anyone's mission to do that. So, okay, I think that's it. Thank you very much.
Shane's paper is on our website if you're interested, techpolicyinstitute.org. It's the first thing on the page. I highly commend it to everyone. And also, please read everyone's bios. I'm not doing people justice, but these are all very distinguished people. So next we have Chris King from Stephan Nicholas. And do we have your presentation up?
Yep. Okay. Thank you, and thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you today in light of the performance of the capital markets over the course of the last 12 months or so. We, as Wall Street analysts, are very much pleased to be invited to speak anywhere these days, particularly without a subpoena attached to it. So I do appreciate the opportunity. Real quickly, in terms of current broadband statistics, and again, some of this does come from the Pew Internet survey. Right now, broadband is currently available to 85 to 90% of homes nationwide. 95% of cable subscribers have access to broadband. But only 55% of households subscribe to broadband today. So, you know, backing out of those numbers, roughly 30% of all households in the U.S. have access to broadband and choose not to pay for it, certainly at the current prices. According to the Pew Internet survey, you know, 33% of those that do not have broadband access say they're simply not interested really at any price, just don't have any need for broadband. Only 12% of those that do not use the Internet at all say it is because they don't have access. So when we're talking about things like stimulus packages to provide broadband services to completely unserved areas in rural America, these are some of the statistics that we need to be thinking about. On the next slide, we have just a quick kind of snapshot that actually is part of our packet that we give to our institutional investor clients, really showing the general trends over the course of the last several years on broadband growth across the country, as well as the ratio between the Bells and the cable companies in terms of who is taking broadband share. Certainly the graph on the right, the year-over-year high-speed net adds growth, does show a marked deceleration in growth. Largely, again, that is because that the broadband market, we believe, is pretty much saturated, certainly in the U.S. at this point, outside of the remaining 10 to 15% of the households that do not currently have access to broadband. You know, this is not a new technology any longer. People have had the opportunity to make the decision whether they would like to subscribe to broadband or not. Next slide, talking about grants in unserved areas, depending on either the House or Senate bill as it is presently constituted, or was at least constituted as of last night as they worked their way through this process. Roughly half of the monies appear to be set aside for providing broadband service in some way, shape, or form to completely unserved areas, areas that do not have any access to broadband today. Keep in mind as well that if I do have a natural paradigm, I do spend my days covering the telecom and cable service providers as companies from an investment standpoint. So I certainly may have a natural bias in terms of their interests in this. But certainly in our view versus what's being discussed now, we believe a more coordinated stimulus package is likely required to incent further broadband deployment. In our view, this should include both tax credits and ongoing support mechanisms. As to the answer why, I'm going to run you through two quick case studies here. These are both from CenturyTel, which CenturyTel made as part of an ex parte filing to the FCC about a year and a half ago. The first one is from Rosendale, Missouri. This is a town in Missouri with roughly 288 access lines in it, 88% of those residential. The costs that CenturyTel believes that it would have to deploy to provide DSL service to this town is roughly $350,000 all in. This, according to the House stimulus proposal that's out there, as well as the Senate proposal, this would be an investment that would be subject to either a grant or a broadband loan package right now that would incent CenturyTel to provide service here. However, that's only half of the battle. Transport costs of roughly $1,200 per month would be incurred for T1s to backhaul traffic to the internet node. This is where CenturyTel, as a telecom carrier, runs into real problems in terms of providing broadband service to some of these more rural areas. This bill will not cover everyone in the town of Rosendale. Slightly less than half of the households live well beyond the 18,000 feet from the central office, which really precludes them from ever receiving DSL access without building an entire new central office, and those costs would certainly be prohibitive. But assuming a roughly 40% take rate over 5 years, which is higher than the current penetration level that CenturyTel does enjoy as a company, this yields roughly 40 DSL customers at the end of year five. Pricing that at an initial $35 per month down to $28 per month over the course of that 5 years gives CenturyTel revenues over that five-year period of roughly $48,000. Even excluding the capital costs, the operational cost of providing that service would be $93,000 over that five-year time frame. So broadband rates would have to average over $90 a month just for the carrier to break even on an operating expense basis, not allowing the company any return on that investment and ignoring the capital commitments. So the point here is, even if the government goes out and gives them a grant to build out this community and offer them DSL service, it is in no way profitable for the company to do so unless they're charging these people $90 a month for DSL service. The next case study here is even worse, actually. This is the slightly smaller town of Gorin, Missouri. 149 access lines in this town. A new $6,000 DSLAM, which is a network equipment piece that helps provide DSL service, would need to be deployed in the town. But two T1s would need to be purchased from an RBOC in Gorin at a cost of $1,640 per month. The initial build, assuming a DSLAM would be acquired, would cover 76% of the market, or 113 access lines. Over 5 years, you can assume that roughly 36 DSL customers would sign up for the service. And again, kind of using the same level of a pricing, gives CenturyTel revenues of roughly $43,000 over 5 years and operating expenses of over $117,000. Here you would need to price broadband at roughly $130 per month for DSL service, again, just for the company to break even without allowing the company a return on investment at all. So again, just kind of working through the economics, the bigger issue, quite frankly, for a lot of these companies in the completely unserved areas is not really the cost of initially coming in and deploying DSL. It's the ongoing operational expenses of purchasing transport primarily from the Bells to provide service to a primary internet node. A little bit more on RLAC economics, the rural independent telecom carriers. A quick survey that we've done over the last couple of weeks suggests that the average cost across footprints to provide DSL service to an unserved customer would average between $2,000 and $3,000. Incremental investment is required to extend fiber farther out into the network, to reduce loop lengths, as well as installing broadband-enabling economics. If you are talking about increasing downstream speeds to roughly 6 megabits, essentially doubling what they're getting now on an average kind of DSL service, that would essentially double the per-home investment cost. So you'd be talking about a $4,000 to $6,000 cost to provide a 6-megabit service, roughly. So the conclusion that we have for RLX and really the unserved market out there, the last 10 to 15% of homes in the country, we believe that the current plans that are being talked about, or at least that have been made public so far, are unlikely to do much to stimulate private sector investment in unserved areas. We believe that a more comprehensive support structure is needed, again, if the public policy is decided upon that this is in the best interest of the country to spend this money to deploy broadband. Capital commitment support, you know, certainly grants are a key component of that. There has been some discussion of broadband loans being put in place. You know, keep in mind that these are companies that generally, and even in this environment, do have pretty much constant access to the capital markets. They can get loans anytime they want. AT&T last night priced, I think it was a $5.5 billion bond deal. So these companies generally have constant access to the capital markets. Loans, in our view, really won't impact their investment decisions at all. But what they really need, at least in terms of these unserved areas, is some support mechanism in terms of the operational expenses that they're going to be incurring. We would you know, certainly suggest something like tax credits to perhaps offset middle mile investment that is providing their own transport link to internet nodes. Some very aggressive tax credit could enable these companies to avoid a lot of those operational expense costs down the road, as well as perhaps a potential re-regulation of special access, which is essentially those transport costs that the bells are charging. One thing to keep in mind there for us kind of telecom policy wonks is that a lot of these are, you know, price cap carriers, so that you know, has to be part of the equation in terms of looking at the re-regulation of some of the special access. In terms of tax credits, one group has suggested tax credits of, you know, 60% in unserved areas and at least 35% in underserved areas, that is, areas that do not have fast enough broadband speeds, essentially. We do note against this backdrop, our models right now have capital spending for telecom and cable across the board, really, to fall roughly 10 to 15% overall in 2009 versus 2008 levels, simply given the macroeconomic outlook and uncertainty that's out there. The large telecom labor union, the CWA, has recommended the tax credit programs assume the capital spending above 85% of 2008 levels be eligible for tax credits. If we're right in kind of our 10 to 15% range, that would, you know, barely get them any type of a relief. Certainly in 2009, we would be looking at kind of a longer-term stimulus there. Another problem with tax credits at the end of the day is that you do have companies like Clearwire and Qwest Communications that are not currently paying any federal income taxes at all, so the tax credits would be very unlikely to benefit them at all, really, for the foreseeable future, given their current financial situations. Other issues, real quickly, in terms of underserved areas out there, and this is largely going off the House bill, but we believe the Senate bill is somewhat similar. The wire line high-speed thresholds in current proposals, they're talking about a 45 megabit download speed threshold, 15 megabits upstream. In our view, this will likely only benefit, you know, Verizon's Fios, Fiber to the Home initiative, and possibly cable's DOCSIS 3.0 platforms today, certainly over the course of the next couple of years. Those are really the only two large-scale platforms that today are capable of delivering that type of speed on the landline side. Wireless broadband plans could potentially benefit, you know, Clearwire, which is a WiMAX provider. There is some speculation that, depending on the exact wording of these stimulus packages, Clearwire could be a beneficiary. We note that, you know, in terms of the $6 to $9 billion in total that the broadband stimulus bills seem to be centering around, Clearwire in and of itself is going to have roughly a $2 billion to $5 billion funding gap over the course of the next several years as a company in order to fully fund their business plan. So even if they were to get a substantial portion of the entire bill, they would still have funding issues down the road. As well as Verizon and AT&T with their LTE long-term evolution 4G wireless development plans, Verizon has talked about having LTE trials up and running in major cities by year-end 2009, really close to a nationwide footprint by 2010, those companies could benefit from some of these wireless stimulus plans. two significant potential issues in the Senate bill that we've been looking at over the last couple of days as analysts. One, the draft language appears to suggest restricting company participation in the form of grants to public-private partnerships. This is a significant complication in our view, which would likely disincent investment, certainly from the companies that I cover. We tend to look back on the kind of the failed municipal Wi-Fi model where various cities and municipalities tried to go in and build their own municipal Wi-Fi networks offering free Wi-Fi service. Most of those major ones have failed miserably over time. Also, there has been some talk in some circles, certainly, although this is a little unclear, about the definition of an unserved area being expanded to include areas with only one broadband provider. This would appear to artificially incent competition in a lot of these areas against an incumbent broadband provider. Certainly in some cases, you know, I think you can make a legitimate public interest argument for something like that, but we also go back to kind of our view of certainly a failed UNIP type of model that artificially incented competition for a certain period of time. When that went away, you had a lot of the collapses of the CLEC industry as a whole, and that really failed to do much, in our view, for the longer-term public interest. In conclusion, real quickly, in our view, solutions particularly related to the broadband stimulus bill must address both the initial investment costs of the network and the ongoing operational deficits in unserved areas. We believe this could include substantial tax credits for capital expenditures. Also, perhaps, you know, given the results from the Pew survey, perhaps a universal service like Lifeline and LinkUp program for advanced services that would aid low-income families, many of them are in rural areas, by relieving them of some of the burdens of the monthly broadband fees, as well as support mechanisms that not only include grants for broadband deployment in rural areas, but also, again, ongoing support that would help offset the material operational expenses. Significant tax credits, in our view, is the most likely, most effective stimulus tool at policymakers' disposal, in our view. Tax incentives are available on day one after the legislation is signed. Easy for companies to implement, normally have a quick impact on investment decisions by these companies. They also leverage substantial private investment by companies that have the capability to deploy and operate these advanced networks, and generally come with very few strings, giving companies ample flexibility, which is particularly important in this type of economic uncertainty and general overall environment. Two more quick points. You know, we are wary of plans that include artificially incenting competition in the broadband market. In addition to the what may possibly be a strained definition of underserved markets, as well as a mandate for the public-private partnerships to be eligible to receive grant monies. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chris. Next, James, do you want to see? Sure, say that's fine. James Assey from National Cable Telecommunications Association.
No. There we go. Thank you, and it's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you, Scott, for the invitation, obviously sharing this table with Shane and Bob and their economics background, and Chris and Christoph and their finance and business background. I'm exceedingly glad that I stayed at a Holiday Inn Express last night, but... I want to talk briefly, probably more from a policy angle than an economics angle, about the stimulus package and more broadly, I guess, about broadband policy and how the cable industry views both the path forward and the challenge today. When I think about the stimulus package and our efforts to really make a difference and move the needle, I'm also of the view that we have to really look at a bunch of the ideas out there through a number of different screens. There's obviously the politicians will always look through a political screen. We need to look from a matter of long-term broadband policy, what makes sense screen, and then there's kind of a short-term economic stimulus screen. And I, you know, in my mind, think of somebody pouring, you know, whether it's dirt or, you know, panning for gold or whatever, and seeing what comes out at the bottom that makes the most sense at this point in time with respect to sensible broadband policy and economic stimulus. I agree with much of what Chris just said, and let me just highlight on the broadband policy point what I think the challenges or the issues that we face. The first and really the foremost is a consumer demand issue. Whether you talk about adoption or you talk about affordability, the issue is people who could get broadband but don't. The second issue you face is one of infrastructure supply. What are the true unserved areas? And as Chris just said, you know, cable essentially provides broadband or makes it available to, you know, 92-95% of households, depending upon what universe you're looking at. So it's actually a very small number of people who are truly unserved. That doesn't mean it's not very expensive to get broadband to those people, but we should keep our eye on that as well. And then the third element is really kind of the quality of the connection, the speed. Where are we today? Where do you think we should be tomorrow? Are we at a point of stasis, or are our companies evolving as they evolve their networks to next generation? So those, to me, seem to be the three elements that we end up focusing on. And I also think in addressing the problem, it's important to, you know, think about what we know and what we don't know. One of the things that we kind of just skip over, at least in this stimulus package, is the money that is included for broadband mapping grants. This is kind of the culmination of what was included in S-1492 that passed the Congress last year to actually get a sense of what are the truly served and truly unserved areas.
That's right. Agreeing with Bob's point completely, but being very concrete about what people are trying to do there.
Another, just to follow up on the jobs issue again, I don't know the answer to this question. You know, it's important if we want anything to be for stimulus, it has to be on the margin, right? It has to be additional. And as Christoph said, a lot of these expenses in rolling this out is labor, basically, right? But there haven't been many mass layoffs in telecom yet, if you look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And so that means there's not a huge army of unemployed telecom workers to take these jobs, to make them new jobs. And so I wonder where, you know, if it were even possible to do things on the margin in this case, or are these jobs more fungible? So, for example, there have been mass layoffs in construction and including in heavy industry and civil engineering. And, you know, are those people, could those people step into new jobs where they're ones? I don't know if anybody knows the answer.
Well, if deploying fiber or something in unserved areas, if it were to go that far, I mean, clearly the people who do that don't have to be people currently employed by a telecom company. I mean, this is construction job right there.
So just
anyone can trench in that. Yeah.
Also, just to that point, just two quick points that I'll make there. First of all, you are beginning to see some telecom layoffs. Sprint this week announced that they were laying off, you know, 13% of their workforce. Obviously, that's Sprint. Sprint has their own issues right now as a wireless company, clearly. On the wireline side, too, you have to remember that you have fairly heavily unionized workforces, which also makes kind of immediate near-term layoffs a little more tricky for the companies to deal with.
Although AT&T has managed to do so.
Yeah. So, mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think both, you know, are certainly an option. I mean, the FCC has talked about, and Kevin Martin, the former chairman, certainly raised the point from time to time about looking into the possibility of re-regulating special access. You know, clearly, the Bells have been dead set against that, have, you know, brought their political pressure to a bear. At the end of the day, it is a very high-margin business for the Bells. I don't think that anyone, you know, debates that. There is a lot of investment that they need to make in that business, and margins have been coming down over the last several years in special access too. But you know, certainly some level of, so I mean, providing a tax credit, so a CenturyTel could go in and build their own transport link or something like that would be a possibility as well. I mean, people that talk about, you know, wanting competition,
you know, that would be a way to incent that. That would be a way to create jobs. That would be a way to alleviate the long-term problem of having to subsidize it as well.
So the debate's focusing too much on residential broadband as opposed to sort of what comes after, before the last mile?
Yeah, well, certainly the point was that in these rural areas that the transport and backhaul is a significant portion of the operating expenses, and it makes it very difficult for these companies to make a go of it on a rate of return basis, even if you subsidize the build-out of DSL in these areas.
But if you get more aggregation of these small companies in rural areas, I mean, up where I'm living, going to in New Hampshire, Fairpoint is our carrier. They simply took over the Verizon operation up there. They provide their own backhaul across all these communities. They're essentially the rural carrier, but the dominant rural carrier up there. And if we got away from our fragmented thousands of subsidized small mom and pop rural telephone companies, we might get a more efficient deployment of backhaul.
If we have somebody from the Antitrust Division of the Justice Department here, would they like to comment on the merger? No, I'm just kidding.
I mean, I would say that just in terms of looking at the financial metrics and the other metrics that people on this panel have laid out, I mean, just kind of sitting here listening to everything from a personal standpoint, it's hard to believe that there are not better ways for a government to be spending $6 to $9 billion than trying to shove broadband out in the most rural areas in the country, or subsidizing AT&T and Verizon to build out faster speeds to more and more of their footprint on a very incremental basis, with money that they could already get from the public marketplace anyway. So short answer is, yes. I mean, I think to a certain extent that, broadband, I mean, everybody likes broadband that has it, generally speaking. The general kind of public perception of it is that it is in the nation's best interest to have broadband, and everybody likes to point to the statistics that shows the U.S. is 14th or 15th in broadband penetration. And why is that? And I think we've kind of laid out several of the reasons why here. But yes, meaning, I think that Obama was kind of early with that on the campaign trail and made that a focal point. And hence here it is in the stimulus package.
I would have to say, in answer to your 12 questions, I have two responses, and very two different instincts that pull in very different directions. One is, my day job is I teach MBAs, and at a first-rate MBA school, but the plain fact is they're scared out of their wits right now, and that's because, I have to be honest with them. I've never seen economic conditions like this in my lifetime. I'm just not old enough to remember the last time we had a liquidity trap. You're right, it's something in a textbook. I learned about it in grad school. That's something in the macro literature that just hasn't shown up in the United States since the 30s. And so, frankly, that scares the hell out of me. There's a non-trivial probability next year we'll be in double-digit unemployment. Okay, in the face of that, one instinct is spend like crazy. I don't care what you spend it on, put people to work, because we have a demand downturn that we're trying to avoid. Right, so that's one set of instincts, and I've got to be real honest, right? That has nothing to do with broadband. It's just good old macro. Find something to spend it on. Hire people to dig ditches if they do something socially useful at the same time. That would be really great. That's a line in Keynes. Okay, so that's one instinct, and so broadband shows up because what do you know? You actually do have to dig dishes. Yeah, or the tunnel. Okay, so that's one instinct. And then on the other hand, we all have the same reaction, which is, it's costly, it's hard to see the returns and so on, especially in the 18 months. There's a second instinct, a quite different set of instincts, which is that the time period we're in terms of the deployment of high speed, just think long term for a second, not 18 months, not panic, think 5 years. Boy, does this country need a third access channel. We have cable, we have DSL, and we need a wireless channel that's mass market capable, and we don't have one right now. I mean, it's for people who are on the frontier, the wireless channel is wonderful. I mean, I have an iPhone, and it's great, but most people can't afford it, and it's not mass market technology, not yet anyway. But if I'm thinking 5 years out, the benefits of the country to having a mass market wireless high-speed access channel is enormous. And right, and that's a different. That's a. I'm just being technology neutral here. I don't care whether it's LTE or WiMAX, but something that's effective, and low cost. Right. That's. It's got to be mass market, and that. That's a whole different set of instincts. Right. And so that's when I react to your question by saying, well, I know we're grabbing broadband because it's the thing that's in front of us, but there's a whole other set of instincts that, if we're thinking long term, we would want to think. About the social, countrywide benefits to having a third access channel.
But Shane, by far the most rapid source of broadband growth is wireless now.
Yeah,
it may not
sure.
be the broadband you want. It's not as fast.
It's not mass market, yeah.
Right, it's a 3G channel broadband.
Yeah.
And that is being upgraded to something faster, so you may get it without any further intervention of any kind. But I think the answer to your question about why this was an issue early on is the answer that Chris gave. No, we're behind in broadband. And on that issue, Scott Lawson has written the most. Those numbers are distorted because they are stated as broadband lines per 100 people, and therefore they don't correct for average household size, and they don't correct for the share of those lines that are business lines. And once you correct for both of those, there's only a handful of countries that are ahead of us in terms of broadband diffusion across households, a very small number.
Just one more point on the wireless broadband front too, not to kind of setting aside the policy ramifications of this, but from a financial standpoint, we find it very difficult to see anywhere in the world where 3G technology has really made any money for the carriers yet outside of perhaps Asia. Europe had it for years before we did, and they've been struggling for years to make money at it. And if you look at that data, wireless data revenues in the U.S. today, 75% of them are either, you know, BlackBerry related or text messaging or ringtone downloads. So, you know, even though people have 3G handsets and 3G's out there and you pull up your phone and you're roaming on a 3G network, in terms of the 3G applications that people are actually using, it's very small today. Now, that almost certainly will change over time.
I wanted to make just a couple of comments myself. I think one of the things we really need to know about wireless is how substitutable are wireless and wireline empirically? What is the elasticity of substitution between the two? And there isn't any good research on that yet. So it's something we really need to know to evaluate competition properly. Otherwise, people are just saying things without really knowing. And the second is, I thought Shane's answers to the two points were interesting, and also because they show the conflicting nature of the stimulus bill. Because on the one hand, if you really want stimulus, maybe you do want fiber to nowhere, even if it doesn't connect anybody, right? Because then people are digging those ditches and putting fiber in, and somebody's making the fiber and so on. But if you want to do something that's more long-term and lasting, maybe it doesn't give you any quick jump. And so it's not clear that we can do both of those things, or how we do both of those things at the same time, I guess.
I'm having fun, because for once, Bob is more pessimistic than I was. But I think
also an important thing is you're bringing up the distinctions between wireless broadband, cable, fiber, satellite, and these are distinctions that until right now we have not been making in our conversation except for cable and wireless. So I think that's another thing that we need to be looking at when we're talking about broadband. What are we really discussing, and what are we really subsidizing? Are we going to subsidize wireless? Okay, that actually sounds interesting to me.
Okay, I think we probably could do, if anybody has one more quick question before we get kicked out of here at gunpoint. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to ask whether anybody has a perspective on, leaving aside all the different technologies and whether we're behind or ahead relative to other parts of the world, none of that really matters if your goal is like universal telephone service, universal electricity. That was really expensive. Nobody knew, but I think that's their goal, And you might not agree with how they're doing it, but that is their goal. Everybody has this thing.
But
just like everybody has electricity and everybody has phones.
Does anybody want to comment.
That's sort of like the goal of everybody having digital television if they don't know how to use it, right? I mean, that's the problem. I mean, it's really different. Using broadband is a lot more complicated than turning on the light switch.
Okay. Well, I think we need to wrap up. So I want to thank the panelists. And also, one more quick thing. I think everybody here has cited the Pew statistics. And I don't think John Horrigan and the people at the Pew Internet Foundation get enough credit for stepping in to provide this public good where the census dropped out in 2003. So hopefully the census will start doing this again with their current population survey. But anyway, so just to say that. And so thank you very much to the panelists for all coming. I thought it was very interesting. Thank you.